With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning into the AgNet News Hour today. Coming up later, 2023 was one of the worst years on record for fruit fly infestations in California. Also, the deadline is extended for clean truck check requirements. We'll have more on that. But we start out today with this week's Chill Hour report. Here's Brian German.
In this week's California Chill Hour report, brought to you by Dormex, wake up your buds with Dormex. Today we're joined by Jerry Watson, owner of Watson Ag Irrigation and Chemical, farming about 500 acres of table grapes, almonds, and pistachios out in Fresno County. And now, Jerry, I understand that you've been working on some trials out there in some of your pistachio acreage, seeing how Dormex might help out some of your production. So let's get into that work you've been doing out there and how your trees have seemed to respond.
Well, 2 years ago when I found the labeled Dormex in pistachios, you know, quite familiar with it, using it in my table grapes. So I decided to put on a plot and see if it helped. So what I did is I mixed it at full rate, sprayed it at 100 gallons an acre with an air sprayer, which came out to like 12 rows in my planting. As the year progressed and pistachios set, I kept looking and checking, and I couldn't see where the 12 rows ended, you know. And it looked like it went over to maybe 17 or 18 rows. Well, I asked my foreman who was managing the job at the time, I said, what happened? Did you really only do just 12 rows or you do more? He said, well, Jerry, remember it was windy and I called you and asked you, should we stop? And you said, no, go, because timing of the, you know, of the product is more important than, and I knew it wasn't going to blow out of my field. I was on the north, spraying the north side, and the wind's coming from that direction across the field. So anyway, kept watching it, and it definitely looked better. So when it came time to harvest, I had the harvester guy said, I want to, you know, do those 12 rows separate. And so we harvested the whole field, and then we did those 12 rows separate. And when I figured it out, I made like 266 pounds a row more out of that plot of 12 rows than the rest of the field. So I started thinking, I said, well, I think I'll do it again next year. That was 2 years ago that I did that.
And information from the UC Davis Chill Calculator shows that as of January 2nd, the Durham Simmons Station has logged 35.7 portions under the dynamic model with 559 hours below 45 degrees. The station in Manteca has registered 32.3 portions with 478 hours. There have been 613 hours in Merced with 30.6 cumulative portions. In 5 points, there have been 482 chill hours, equating to 29.4 portions. Finally, the Simmons Station in Shafter has registered 28.8 portions with 493 hours. And this has been the California Chill Hour Report brought to you by Dormex. Tune in again next week for another episode where we continue our conversation with Jerry Watson and the benefits he's seen with Dormex and his pistachios.
2023 had some surprises for the world of agriculture. Here's Gary Crawford with more.
You might recognize this. It's part of that 1978 Kenny Rogers song hit, The Gambler.
Said if you're gonna play the game, boy, you gotta learn to play it right.
Play it right. And as we look back now at how farmers played the game in 2023.
The farmers showed a lot of flexibility in planting coming into this year.
USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer says that word flexibility really applies to how producers shifted their plantings to adjust to weather and market conditions.
We survey farmers as to their intention, and then we come back and we survey them to what they actually did. And I think we had some movement, at least from what they signaled their initial thoughts about what they were going to do, and then what they actually did in response to the market saying, hey, can we have a little bit more of this crop or that crop?
In March, corn growers said they intended to plant 92 million acres to corn, but by planting time, the market signals changed. Farmers reacted by planting over 94 million acres to corn. Meanwhile, For soybeans, farmers in March intended to plant 87.5 million acres, but decided to cut that down to 83.5, one of the biggest March to June acreage changes on record. That was one surprise, and 2023 certainly brought us some other surprises along the way. Seth Meyer says among those surprises,
overall crop yields pretty darn good for corn and soybeans, for instance, on a crop that didn't really have all that favorable of growing conditions.
In fact, at harvest time, one Iowa corn grower told us,
it's remarkable the yields that we're pulling out given the limited rainfall we had.
And of course, Seth Meyer says despite some very hot, very dry weather over a lot of the country,
we had crops and yields just slightly below trend, just a little bit below trend. Below trend, yes, but just a little bit below trend. But given the farmers' response to the demands for corn early on, we had a record large corn crop.
15.2 billion bushels, 11% more than the 2022 crop. Truly remarkable. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you just want to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search for AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will return in just a moment. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. In today's National Spotlight, the first ever honeybee vaccine is a buzzing triumph in pollinator perfection. Helena McNamee shares more.
One out of every three bites of food that you eat depends on pollination services provided by bees, butterflies, bats, and more. The United States Department of Agriculture even goes as far as to say that the health and safety of pollinators can have direct impacts on U.S. agriculture, food security, and the nation's overall economy. This is why we should be protecting our pollinators like our lives depend on it, because as dramatic as it sounds, they kind of do.
This is not just being able to, you know, have wonderful sweet tea and candy, but it's medicine, it's our food. It's so far reaching what these little animals do. They're absolutely critical part of our food supply chain.
When Annette Kleiser, the CEO and co-founder of Dalen Animal Health Incorporated, and her team got together, they realized that they could not just sit back and watch the devastation that pollinators were experiencing any longer. That is when the first of its kind vaccine for honeybees came to life.
You know, three women that got together and said, we have to do something. These animals are so important, and everybody throws their hands up and said, we have to change something. And we just said, okay, let's not wait. Let's just see if we can do something. Let's just see if this is possible.
The vaccine helps build immunity for American fowl brood, AFB for short, a fatal bacterial disease that is caused by the spore-forming bacterium Panobacillus larvae. This disease is considered to be one of the most widespread and devastating bacterial diseases affecting honeybee colonies worldwide.
The disease-forming bacteria are believed to be in about 45 to 50% of all hives out there. These bacteria can turn virulent and start infecting larvae and start spreading in the colony, and then are carried by the worker bees from one colony or left on the flowers where another bee from another colony can pick them up and bring them home. And so they spread really, really quickly once you have an outbreak.
Some countries have explored antimicrobials as an alternative control method. However, strains of the bacteria started to show signs of resistance, raising concerns about the efficacy of this approach. Consequently, the most effective control method for AFB involves the incineration of diseased colonies, all products derived from the bees, and all contaminated equipment.
So it's a very, very costly disease if it hits you.
Rest assured, there are no crazy scientists chasing honeybees down and sticking them with needles. The method of delivering this vaccine is, in fact, much simpler.
It's an oral vaccine. Queens don't like to eat themselves, so nurse bees will take up the sugar paste with the vaccine, and when they produce royal jelly from that sugar paste. The vaccine comes with it in the royal jelly, is then fed to the queen, and the queen takes it up, digests it from there into the ovaries. This transgenerational immune priming is a natural mechanism that insects have. When the maternal insect encounters a pathogen, she will take it up and will naturally pass it on to her offsprings to protect them.
The work does not end with the AFB vaccine, though. Kleiser says that there are more vaccines in the works for other diseases. She recognizes that a vaccine is not the silver bullet to change, but she says that it is a step in the right direction to truly protecting honeybees.
European foul brood is another big disease that in the last years also was treated with antibiotics prophylactically. Chalk brood is another disease. It's a fungal brood disease that we're trying to tackle. And ultimately down the road, but it's a little bit more in the future, the viral deformed wing virus.
Again, that was Annette Kleiser, the CEO and co-founder of Dalen Animal Health Incorporated. And I'm Helena McNamee.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, value on the hoof correlates to value on the rail. The United States Meat Export Federation knows this best. Working closely with producers, livestock trade organizations, and the USDA, USMEF works hard to ensure that U.S. protein is found center plate around the world. Access to foreign markets for U.S. red meat is vital for the livestock industry. To learn more about the expanding access to foreign markets, I visited with Randy Spronk, a Minnesota crop and livestock producer and current chairman of U.S. Meat Export Federation.
You know, I think it's really, as we, you know, it's not something that you accomplish within 1 year. This is a multi-year, multi-decade, you know, effort. You know, I'm so thankful by the leadership that came before we're here that got the free trade agreements, that lower tariffs and lower non-tariff trade barriers that allow our product to be able to move, in, that can move into these countries. That's really the first step to getting any red meat into these countries. Anytime we can lower those barriers, American agriculture is so productive. We're going to move in. Japan's the prime example of that. You know, I think back to the free trade agreements we got back in 2012. You would have had Colombia, South Korea, Panama. You look at those countries here now that we've been, the trade agreements are in full effect over 10 years. So all of a sudden, there is no zero tariffs. You look at Korea, number one beef export, you know, phenomenal. Beef short ribs in there, it's just a great product. Korean barbecue, what a great way to add value to a beef product here. You start talking about, from the pork standpoint, it's our number four. You know, we didn't have that before here. You look at Colombia. Colombia, you know, everybody thought about the drugs and what was going on down there. Here, it's a phenomenal market for us, coming up in another fifth hold in pork production here, or excuse me, pork exports. You know, per capita consumption, you know, 12 pounds per head, now it's in the mid-20s here. You've doubled per capita consumption over a 10-year period. So that's what happens when we use checkoff funding in cooperation with USDA MAP funding, and we actually promote U.S. proteins, beef, pork, and lamb in these countries. We will grow market share.
This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will return in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
2023 was a challenging year for invasive fruit fly detections in California. Director of Government and Public Policy for the California Fresh Fruit Association, Adam Borchard, said there were more than 700 detections made throughout the state last year.
Which is, I mean, a magnitude greater than what we usually see in an annual average. Some weeks we've seen more fruit fly detections than in previous years, and never before has California had seen higher than 500 detections. So this is definitely a record-breaking year on pest detections. And there's probably a number of reasons why we're seeing such high numbers, and we are now finally out of the post-COVID pandemic interruptions in trade and other movement of people and goods. So we're likely seeing an increased movement of pest-infested goods and materials through ports of entry.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture is hiring 40 climate change fellows to address the surge in applications for clean energy projects under the Rural Energy for America program. Funded by President Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, these positions aim to support farmers and rural businesses seeking funding for clean energy initiatives. The act allocated $2 billion to REAP, with $1.25 billion already available, resulting in a notable increase in grant applications. The fellows will be part of the USDA Climate Change Fellows Program, contributing diverse skills to address climate change and agricultural challenges while fostering economic growth. Most states will receive additional funds announced at a later date to provide REAP technical assistance in addition to these staffing positions. The fellows will work across various states with a focus on expanding the use of wind, solar, and clean energy and enhancing energy efficiency. The Ag Census from the U.S. Department of Agriculture captures changes in the farm sector and provides data that benefits more than just the agricultural industry. Joe Prusacki of the National Agricultural Statistics Service said things have changed dramatically since he first started his involvement with the Census of Agriculture back in 1997.
In that census, you can track it through and see what's going on county by county to see what's happening. And there's a lot of people other than, I use the word ag, I'm air quoting ag people, that look at the census. Somebody says, oh, hey, I'm not a farmer, but you know, it does impact you. Because the census has data in there that industry folks, they'll look at and they'll say, you know what? Based on these information, it looks like maybe there's a bunch of small farms coming into this particular area, this particular county. Maybe we'll put a store in here. Well, what does that do? It brings jobs. It brings tax money to your local area. So it does help.
The California Air Resources Board has extended the deadline to register vehicles as part of the Clean Truck Check program. The rule applies to vehicles that exceed 14,000 pounds gross vehicle weight rating and are powered by diesel or alternative fuels, with rare exceptions. The deadline to enter vehicles into the CARB database and pay the annual fee of $30 per vehicle was extended to January 31st. Compliance proof is mandatory for all covered vehicles to continue legal operations in the state, with the Clean Truck Check program tied to registration with the Department of Motor Vehicles. Nearly all vehicles will require testing twice a year through the program. However, agricultural vehicles will only be required to be tested once a year. Compliance tests will begin to be accepted as early as April, and the compliance deadline for testing will be July 1st. The California Department of Food and Agriculture's Office of Environmental Farming and Innovation has granted $9.2 million to six research projects as part of the Livestock Enteric Methane Emissions Reduction Research Program. The funding allocated by the Budget Act of 2022 supports research aimed at evaluating additives and dairy modifications that can reduce enteric methane emissions in the dairy and livestock sectors. The projects will address key impact areas identified during a science summit in May 2023, focusing on practical and effective strategies for reducing methane emissions in livestock operations. Awardees will investigate various different approaches, such as evaluating the effectiveness of feeding additives to dairy cows, looking at cow-calf grazing systems, and other dietary modifications to reduce methane emissions. The initiative aligns with California's ongoing efforts to address climate change and reduce the environmental footprint of the dairy industry. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Looking at some of the top ag issues for 2023, that's coming up on This Land of Ours. The Waters of the U.S. Rural Rewrite topped the list of agricultural issues for the National Agricultural Law Center in 2023. California's Proposition 12 came in second, with the one-year Farm Bill extension third. The organization listed EPA's rollout of the Endangered Species Protection Program and the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act as fourth. Other top issues include the Arkansas foreign ownership of land restrictions, competition in the livestock sector, and water use from the Colorado River. Right to Repair gained traction as farmers continued to advocate for the right to access manufacturer-controlled tools and information. The list rounds out with growth in the industrial hemp sector and civil litigation over pesticides, such as glyphosate exposure. The organization expects corporate transparency rules requiring disclosure of ownership interests in companies and proposed H-2A changes and a myriad of other issues before the Supreme Court as the ones to watch for 2024. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West. This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back. When a USDA meteorologist was recently asked about weather highlights of the past year, he offered a top 10 list, based on somewhat chronological order and not by ranking of the most to least significance. Rod Bain goes over his list of the top weather events and some of their impacts in this edition of Agriculture USA.
Some of the familiar weather events of the year past.
Multiple severe weather outbreaks, the fire that devastated Lahaina, Hurricane Idalia, significant cold waves. That flooding included significant agricultural impacts.
Yet what might constitute the top 10 list of notable weather occurrences in 2023? I'm Rod Bain, USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey joins us with his list of the weather highlights from the past year in this edition of Agriculture USA. What were the weather highlights in the U.S. in 2023? USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey offers his list with this caveat.
It's always tough to try to encapsulate an entire year in one story, but I'm going to try to keep it fairly quick, sort of in a quasi-chronological order here.
The start of his top 10 list of last year's weather events actually began in December 2022, going well into March of the following year, a weather phenomenon called atmospheric rivers that created flooding in parts of the Golden State.
California, that flooding included significant agricultural impacts, such as the return of Tulare Lake in the southern San Joaquin Valley, flooding over 100,000 acres of fertile agricultural land.
A February cold front in New England led to record temperatures and wind chill in places.
It peaked on February 4th in most areas, and included the coldest weather in Boston since January of 1957. We did see an all-time record tying minus 47 degrees atop New England's highest peak, Mount Washington, had tied that all-time record that was set way back in January of 1934. It also came with wind chills at Mount Washington below minus 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Multiple severe weather outbreaks around the nation through 2023 led to, by Christmas,
82 tornado-related fatalities in the United States. We have seen multiple deadly tornado outbreaks, the most recent occurring on December 9th,
and not just tornadic activity either,
but also high winds and hail lasting all the way into early summer. We got a little break, but then we saw a couple of autumn outbreaks.
Drought remained a top weather story despite periods of relief.
We did start off the year with more than 40% drought coverage in the United States. We finally dropped below that threshold in late February for the first time in about 2.5 years since September of 2020. We actually knocked the U.S. drought coverage down to 19% by late May, but by the time we got to October, drought coverage climbed back above 40% for a couple of weeks. That caused significant agricultural impacts in the United States on a variety of crops, as well as cattle, hay production.
Extensive northeast flooding took place for much of late summer, with a second period in December.
The wetness that has been present since July, we really never shook that wetness in northern New England, definitely contributing to some of the renewed flooding that we've seen with this December storminess.
The Lahaina fire in Hawaii this past August resulted in
the deadliest U.S. single wildfire in more than a century since some of the Great North Woods fires back in the early 20th century across Minnesota, Wisconsin, and neighboring states in the upper Midwest. Current death toll there is 100 individuals.
And contrasted, an overall quiet wildfire season in the U.S. in 2023. Looking at tropical systems, Hillary was an Eastern Pacific hurricane, making a rare presence as a tropical storm in the western U.S.
It actually moved into Southern California on August 18th. That system resulted in the first ever tropical storm warning for Southern California. We did see some flash flooding and high winds.
While the most significant hurricane for 2023 was Hurricane Idalia.
It hit south of Perry, Florida on August 30th, and early reports indicating that there were nearly $4 billion worth of damage, as well as 5 fatalities.
Atlantic tropical storm Ophelia was notable in that
long after it had dissipated, some of that moisture worked its way back inland, and by September 29th, we saw extensive flooding in the New York City area.
And finally, due to extreme heat in the deep south through the latter half of 2023,
we did see record-setting heat stretching across the southern border, especially from Arizona to Florida. Some of the worst conditions were in the western and central Gulf Coast states, with some devastating impacts on pastures and also some significant impacts on crops.
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And as we look ahead to 2024, there are some things that we can't predict, among them Mother Nature. Chad Smith reports.
No matter what conditions are like, when you decide to plant, you need to protect your soybean seed investment. Matt Geiger, a Syngenta Agronomic Service representative in Illinois, looks back on 2023 conditions and talks about how you can help your soybeans emerge healthier and stronger in 2024.
Yeah, so the weather here was kind of a roller coaster, and it really was highly dependent on where you were at. But as a general rule, if it was in April / the first half of May, it was cool and wet. After that, it turned off dry and hot essentially until the 4th of July. And then as far as any early season diseases that were a particular threat, any year that you plant April, which is what you want, especially for planting soybeans, there's always a risk of Pythium because Pythium thrives in those cool and wet conditions.
No matter when you plant, you should be vigilant at planting time.
Be ready for any weather conditions. So it could be a cool and wet conditions. If that's the case, you're going to have a threat of Pythium, and Pythium is one of those diseases that can reduce your stands early in the season. If it's warm and wet, you have a risk of Phytophthora, and that's also a disease that can kill your soybeans, reduce your stands, and reduce yield as well. But if you're on the other side of the coin, we often get the question of, do you need a seed treatment if it's hot and dry? And there's actually hot and dry diseases too, and the primary one being a disease called Rhizoctonia can limit your root mass. If it gets bad enough, it can also limit your stand establishment. It can basically girdle the stems off. And you have pretty poor vigor of those plants as well. They just grow really slowly. There's also a disease called Fusarium that thrives in those dry, hot conditions as well.
He talks about how growers can protect their seed from yield-robbing diseases.
Choose a variety that's got good disease scores, and then you want to layer on top of that a good seed treatment. And the seed treatment that Syngenta leads with now is a product called Cruiser Max Apex. We've got fungicides in this product that protect you under all the soil conditions that I discussed. So we've got two active ingredients in that product that are going to protect you against Pythium. And one of those is actually a new mode of action with no known resistance to Pythium. So it's very potent on Pythium species. Two ingredients in Cruiser Max Apex that are effective on Phytophthora. Two active ingredients in this that's effective on Rhizoctonia as well, which is another pretty devastating disease. For vigor and insect control, we've also got a very good insecticide called Cruiser. It's a very well-rounded product that's a good formulation. And at the end of the day, really what you want to use a seed treatment for is to get faster emergence and more uniform emergence. You just want to prevent replants, especially in soybeans.
Ready to see how Cruiser Max Apex can supercharge your protection? Talk to your local retailer today or visit SyngentaUS.com/CruiserMaxApx. Always read and follow label instructions. Chad Smith reporting.
This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. My friend and colleague Susan Littlefield is in Tucson, Arizona this week at the Water Street Edge Conference. There she met up with one of the speakers, Dr. David Cole, who talked on a number of topics. And she brings us today's featured interview.
Talk a little bit about agricultural economics and business trends that we see in the 20s and the fact that things are moving forward with some interesting facets you're going to have to think about when you're looking at your operation. Hi, I'm Susan Littlefield. We are on the road today in Tucson, Arizona for Water Street Solutions Edge Conference. And I'm so excited because Dr. David Cole joins me right now, a professor emeritus, agricultural applied economics. I could go on and on just about your bio alone, Dr. Cole, but so many things. I mean, when you were talking, you could have heard a pin drop in that room as folks really sucked in everything that you were talking about. And I kind of wanted to start out, you made a comment that kind of caught my ear that some of our countries, especially when you're looking at the European Union, moving away from this green movement that has been pushed down our throats for so long.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you're starting to see, particularly in the Netherlands, it's called greenlash. In other words, people are lashing back at the green energy movement. Particularly, there's inconsistent policies going on around the world. India and China are adding coal-fired plants, while other nations are, you know, the green initiatives. And when economies get tight, people go back to the pocketbook. And so the term greenlash, I think we're going to hear more and more of that. And again, artificial intelligence, it kind of goes through an infatuation stage and then goes through the disillusionment stage. Same thing with green energy. So it's going to be interesting to watch that one play out.
So how does agriculture then tie into all of that?
I think one of the things we've got to be really careful on the green energy is that, you know, a number of farms have been approached, you know, to put up some do some green energy initiatives. My whole contention is it still going to be profitable after the government subsidies are gone? So I think you have to look at each farm and ranch has to look at their specific situation, but also look in the long term to see if it's going to be sustainable and viable and be what we call in the black without all the subsidies.
One of the other topics you talked about was U.S. becoming a second supplier. And when you mentioned that, I heard just a husband and wife sitting near me said, see, I told you, they don't want to buy stuff from us anymore. Kind of expand on that, because obviously the Southern Hemisphere is really drawing more opportunities.
It sure is. And it was all part of China's Silk and Belt Road Initiative. The leadership of China invested over $1.3 trillion in over 70 countries because they wanted another source of food, fiber, and fuel. And so what's happening is now Brazil stepped up, you know, number one, of course, in beans and corn. And so if the Asian region, who is seeking product, if they can get it from the Southern Hemisphere, and particularly Brazil, Argentina, or Australia, and New Zealand, they're going to go there first, and then they'll come to the United States second. And so I think this is something that we're probably going to have to consider in some of our trade, also some of our export strategies as well. It's on us.
But how does that factor in then with all this new currency talk and everybody says, well, the dollar drops, so we should get some more buys?
Well, that's all good. But in 2024, there's going to be an international meeting of the BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, but also Iran and all those, developing a new digital currency. Now, it's not going to be easy. But if the United States doesn't get our financial and economic house in order, we just leave an avenue for this other currency to get more momentum and come in and challenge. And then what happens is we can't do all the what I call gimmicky things to kind of keep the economy going when we're not the dominant currency in the world.
You brought up a tall order, though, getting our economic house in order. It's going to take a little bit of time to get that done.
It sure is. And of course, probably not going to happen in 2024. It's election year, and it's going to take some tough medicine. And, you know, as I told a group here today in Tucson, you know, we had something in order. It was bipartisan, you know, about 12 years ago, $2 or $3 of budget cuts for every dollar tax increase, but it didn't have enough momentum to go through. And we're probably going to have an economic heart attack to get, you know, people to kind of rally around and behind. I don't mean to be Dr. Doom here, but I have to be Dr. Realistic. It's tough to get things through.
Dr. Cole, I recently spoke with former U.S. Senator Ben Nelson, and he's been really talking and pushing about this proposed tax on unrealized gains and what that's going to mean for the farming industry.
I think we got to be very, very careful on this one because, you know, you can have unrealized gains, but you can also have unrealized losses. And again, it's all approaching all this gargantuous paper wealth that we have built up. I don't care if it's land, stock market, houses, et cetera, et cetera. I think that is a slippery slope that I hope that we don't go down there because, again, have they thought about the unintended consequence? What happens if we have losses?
And he's dead set against this and is advocating for this. But then you also talked to the group today about being more cash heavy.
Yeah, it is. And that comes back to your state, Warren Buffett. He always keeps cash around. And we've used it in our businesses. When you have working capital and then some of that working capital cash, you got flexibility in your marketing program, flexibility if an opportunity pops up, sometimes you can buy it at 75, 80 cents on a dollar. But it's also a shock absorber in case we have a dipsy-doo, we can draw back on those cash reserves. If you really look at it, Great by Choice was a book by Jim Collins, and the companies, only about 1 in 10 companies or businesses keep extra cash around. It's very difficult because that cash burns holes in our pocket. And it's very, very important concept. Only about 1 in 10 get it.
Does that mean having that cash, as you talked about the baby boomers hitting the 70s, the younger baby boomers hitting that 70 mark, what does that mean for agriculture, having that cash opportunity? Is that going to be a good opportunity for us?
Well, you know, the baby boomers, we got to really watch the baby boomers as they go through the retirement phases. And right now, they're purchasing farm ground, et cetera, et cetera. But no one talks about the liquidity crunch that comes in transition. All of a sudden, mom and dad, grandpa, grandma have a health problem. 60% of your health care costs occur in your last 6 months of life. And then the kids that aren't interested in the farm and ranch want it. And so we have a liquidity crunch in transition. This is where cash plays a very, very important role. And very few speakers, very few transition planners talk about this.
We continue with Susan Littlefield and Dr. David Cole right after this. You're listening to the AgNet News Hour, and now we return to Susan Littlefield speaking with Dr. David Cole.
You also talked about strategic planning for the quarter century, and the one thing that caught both me and Michelle Rook, who was sitting next to me, was when you talked about women in management.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And it was interesting to watch a male-dominated audience kind of take it, but they took it. But all you got to do is look at FFA and 4-H. You know, half of the membership in FFA is female. Leadership team, though, 75%. And as I told, there's $68 trillion worth of wealth in the total U.S. economy going to change hands. A third of it's owned by women today. By 2040, it's going to be two-thirds because women outlive men. But the second thing that I'm seeing in my travels and doing speaking engagements, more and more women in management and ownerships of businesses. I will just say this, right here in Tucson, Arizona, from 2024 or 25 to 2040, that's going to be the era of women in management in agriculture. And they're going to play a very integral role in this transition and the competitiveness of the agricultural industry.
So then do you see the trend then of more women wanting to come into events like what is happening here in Tucson? Give me that knowledge. They want to eat it up as fast as they can get it.
Well, you could see it in the audience here today. We had a reception last night. I didn't see too many women come today. They were all in there. And boy, you could just see the nonverbal. They were zoning in on me and locking in. I do observe while I'm speaking. There was a couple of them. They were zoning in. And guess what? There were some sore ribs amongst some of the males as they were kind of hitting them in the ribs as I was going through. But all joking aside, I really see this as a new energy, a positive trend out here. And, hey, 1 and 1 equals 3. And that's why I'm positive and still do these things where I don't have to do it. I still enjoy doing it.
Wrap up a couple more questions for you. You talked about consumer and society driving those trends, and we know that consumers have been in the driver's seat. How does agriculture kind of sit in the middle next to them as they drive and maybe not be the backseat driver but assist them as we see things moving forward?
Well, I think one of the things is you got to keep close touch to that consumer, and we're very fortunate to have the creamery, and so we're right in connect with the consumer. One thing that really concerns me, though, is agriculture consolidates and in many formats, sometimes we commoditize it. We get away from the consumer. And so having that tie to that consumer and how that consumer is changing and the experiential basis that they want, we've really got to be on it. And I'm going to kind of be a little critical of some of our large organizations. They don't realize that that consumer is changing really fast. And they've got to be on top of those trends.
And finally, I think that one of the biggest takeaways for me, and I'm a huge advocate of write those notes. And you ended your conversation with take time, handwrite 3 notes. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, one of the things that I do, and I did it last year, I take an opportunity to write 3 handwritten letters. It's got to be handwritten to people who have had a major influence on my life or maybe need a little hope and help. Makes you feel, it's kind of like an assist in basketball. Makes you feel good, makes them feel good. And do it handwritten. It's authentic. And today, we oftentimes get in this commoditized world, you know, with our texting and all this. The handwritten is authenticity, which I know is still very, very important. I noticed quite a few people wrote that or were underlining that out there. And that's something that I do each and every year.
I shared that on Twitter with all of our followers as well. Dutch Cole, thanks for taking time to talk to us here in Tucson.
Well, and thank you. And you all keep up the good work. And we need individuals and organizations like you to kind of keep the word of agriculture out there. Because remember, no successful culture is out there without success in agriculture.
Very well put. Dr. Cole joining us here in Tucson, Arizona. I'm Susan Littlefield.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.